When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking. Yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap. It's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm Young H.O. Raps Grateful Dead. Back to take over the globe. Now break bread. I'm in.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Miami Nice. I'm your co-host, Blake Howard. It is not 11:47. It's in the AM Sydney time as we record this. I'm here with my partner, Katie Walsh. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
We are waving our checkered flags because the last time that I spoke to this guest was, I think, at like 3 a.m. his time at the Sydney Film Festival. He popped in to introduce a live version of this show for One Heat Minute and was like in an LA car park for some reason because he was like, it was an ungodly time change. He's one of my favorite people. And I just want to quickly, before we start and get silly and have too much fun, genuinely say, when this person noticed that a lunatic in Sydney, Australia had decided to unpack heat a minute at a time, he was so effusive and such a stoker of passion of the lunacy of the project that his word of mouth alone and then his endorsement coming on the show multiple times and then his big secret reveal that Heat wasn't actually his favorite Michael Mann movie. It was indeed Last of the Mohicans, which we got to talk about, which is sensational. I can't tell you what it meant and continues to mean to me. And so I love him. He's a terrific filmmaker in his own right. He's got a brand new movie, Suitable Flesh, which is about to do its festival tour. He really, I mean, fought a war under the kind of awful human being of Frank Grillo and made a terrific movie called Point Blank, which I love in spite of its lead actor so much because of his filmmaking chops. And truly, thank frickin' the maker that we have Shudder in Australia because his terrific mayhem exists on a streaming platform in this freaking country, which is just unbelievable. It's my man, Joe Lynch.
Oh my God. Thank you. Like I need you to introduce me everywhere. Like I also need
just zoom me in.
I will need to allot at least 15 minutes for every time you do it because you are like me. You are a progressive pontificator and I appreciate, look, I am so thrilled to be on this. And to finally, we were saying before, to finally meet Katie, we have been digital ships that have been crossing in the night on Twitter and Letterboxd and all the other social platforms. I've been a fan of her for years. I've loved how you guys have co-joined forces to become the Wonder Twins Activate of genre cinema, if you will.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that like the movies that you guys have picked, because you know, for me, Blake's expansive knowledge of genre, you know, kind of came out through the Heat podcast. It wasn't just about Heat. It was all the other films that Michael Mann, you know, discussed about all the influences and all of Blake's love for, you know, cinema in general, but also specific cinema. You get to know him. And then when it comes to, you know, even just allowing me to reevaluate Inherent Vice or the movie that we're going to talk about, all these different films that you guys have honed in on, I think has allowed us to realize that cinema is an art form in that you can appreciate it subjectively. not everyone is going to love some of the movies that you've discussed. Some of them, like even today, some of the movies that like you guys have discussed in the past, I think have allowed people to go, I really need to reevaluate my feelings towards these movies. Because I think one of the things that's so wonderful about cinema in general, and also Michael Mann, and this is definitely something I want to talk about, is that you know, he is one of those filmmakers that for some reason finds a way to figure out how flaws in the cinematic process, because they have been chosen by him and you, the viewer, are watching it, they cut, they printed it, they showed it to the audience, because he puts conviction behind even mistakes, they're endearing, they're engaging. Mm-hmm. They're not for everybody, you know, that like some people want slick, unmarred cinema, you know, that is like clean as a whistle, very Kubrickian, if you will, very precise. And yet there are filmmakers like him, Paul Thomas Anderson. You can look at half of PTA's films and you can see where someone else would go, that was a fuck up. But because he chose it and put it in the movie, he almost, what's the word? He anointed it with art, you know? And that's the thing that I love about what you guys have been doing for all of these films, is you're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, on so many movies. And I appreciate that, you know, like we as filmmakers would be blessed to have you guys look at like works that we've done. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'm really hoping for that night. It's a badass in the podcast someday. But, you know, like honestly, I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And to be able to have two voices, you know, like involved, I think has struck a really good balance. The Kim Masters episode that you guys did that I listened to again. I love Kim Masters. I've been such
one
a
of
fan
our,
of hers for
one
years.
One of our favorite episodes, Katie. Oh my God.
Mm. What kills me is that I remember that article. And,
and wait, Joe, an episode that has made some people not want to do the show.
Yes.
Really?
We were like, we sent it to someone. We're like, here's a really good episode. And then they were like, no, we're not going to do the show.
That wouldn't want to make me do it more, because even when you have someone who is as well-versed as Kim, I listen to her podcast, The Business, every week. I think she's got a fantastic pulse, and she has for decades. She knows her shit. Mm-hmm. And the article that she put out about Miami Vice, I remember when that came out, and I remember reading it, and I remember going like, in man we trust, we're fine. Like we're forging ahead. And then the fact that she had never seen it too, like I pray that she listened to the episode back, or even if she just like walked away from the episode and just kind of went, you know what, why not? Let me throw it in. You know, the amount of love and care that you guys put into the evaluation of this particular movie. I listened to like three of them. When you first asked me, Blake, I went back and listened to a couple more episodes, but then went, because my partner, Becca, had never seen the movie before, and she's a big Man fan as well, but she kind of read the hype or the anti-hype when the movie came out and went like, oh man, I don't know. You know, like, and then never got to see it. So I got to sit her down. And what's great is that I tended to do this thing where I watch the person I'm watching, like who's watching the movie, I'm like, huh? My lenses. You know, look with Tom Towles from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, crazy. And we were like, and it was so fascinating because I'm the bigger of the two of us. She has like created like a me in a to appreciate classic films and like 70s exploitations and Sergio Corbucci movies way more, and I have brought her into the light of like 80s movies and genre films more. We both kind of you know, come to loggerheads about romantic comedies, of course, but when it comes to slick like genre thrillers, which we watched a lot of when we were making Suitable Flesh, you know, like it was nice to see how she was absorbing it for the first time. And for me, I had not seen the movie since opening night. And even Joey, when the unrated Joey, directors
I, came I, out, we have to, I, we I have to get into
you,
that.
I want to tell you, because it's now like it's 17 years in one day since that. You would have been there on opening night.
I saw it at the Cinerama Dome, and I was so fucking stoked because, like, I got to admit, like, I was wary on Michael Mann going back to that IP for multiple reasons because, you know, for me, it felt like, dude, you can do whatever the fuck you want. Like, and Miami Vice, really? But then again, you know, like, I loved his re-teaming with Jamie Foxx again. I thought he was, you know, obviously they had a kind of Scorsese DiCaprio kind of thing going on at the time, you know, with just their symbiosis with Collateral and Ali. And I was like, bring it on, more, you know, more Fox Man collaborations, I'm in. The pictures of Colin Farrell's mullet, I was like, it's going to be interesting.
Which, for folks who are about to see Suitable Flesh, because we've been able to see a teaser, not the whole movie, just the teaser of the movie. Joe's kind of rocking a bit of Farrell. Like, this is the other thing. He's got a great tash in his own directorial cameo. And your hair is beautiful, Joe, in that trailer.
You were channeling Sonny in your appearance as orderly.
If I would have watched the movie again, I would have slicked my hair back even more. I would have put some more gel in. And I would have, it's funny, it's the first time that I ever heard someone call it a tash. But if you look at Farrell's stash, it looks like a capital T. So yeah. Is that like really the official phrasing of the Colin Farrell stash? It's more of a tash.
Yeah, it's definitely a tash. It needs to be called the tash from now on.
Yes, a new term.
I really want to talk to you guys about this because I've had issues with Mr. Mann for years now. You know, being a fan of his, like a, as Blake knows, an ardent worshiper, like to the point where I, like an apologist, you know, it's like, I will fight a motherfucker over the keep any day of the week. You know, it's like yes. we will come to blows outside the New Bev, you know, for certain movies of his. But when, you know, and there is something to be said about, like, people are talking in the Twitterverse, the lexicon, about these older filmmakers who we've put on these pedestals for years, everybody from Spielberg to, maybe not George Lucas, but, you know, like, we have Michael Mann, and we have Spielberg, and we have, I'm trying to remember who, there was somebody else that I was like, oh, shit, of course.
Friedkin's, you know, one of these guys, too.
Friedkin, Billy. Scorsese, you know, yeah. Fucking Scorsese with that new trailer, you'd think he was a 25-year-old neophyte, you know, just kind of coming out with his guns blazing. There are some, and I got to admit, like, whether between West Side Story and The Fablemans, like, Spielberg, he seems to still have a lot of pep in his step. So with all, and, you know, and look, Michael Mann's new movie is, like, what, premiering at the New York Film Festival and playing in Toronto. It's like, and
I think it's playing Venice.
Ferrari movie.
It's Venice, and it is the New York Film Festival. And just by the way, we know people. We know people who've seen it, and Bill Gabeary called me the other day and was like, hey, it's playing in New York, you want to come see it? And I go, Bilge, if I leave my family and I come to New York City again, I will come home and my house won't be here anymore. My family will be gone. I can't do any more trips for like one night to New York City. It's like more time in the air than the ground.
Blake. When Bilge calls you with an invitation to a Michael Mann movie, you say yes.
Well, I did.
What's wrong with you?
I did last time. I answered the call. Okay. I answered the call. No, I don't know if I can do that in October. Anyway, stop talking to me about it because I'll start thinking about it. We do know that there have been tests, and the word is extremely good. Extremely good. Talk to you more off air. Katie and I don't reveal our sources.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. Since I want to get into it with you guys, because it feels like you both, with the various guests that you've had on and, you know, the different topics that you've done, you guys have covered the gamut of this movie. And at this point, I think if like any new listener or, you know, or what have you is going to listen to my bullshit, you know, and they're going to reevaluate the movie, great, you know, but the thing that I want to come to this, because a lot of times when you listen to appreciation posts or, you know, podcasts dedicated to certain films, in most cases, they are from a positive spin, in most cases. Now, I'm not coming from a negative spin on this movie, because there are things that I absolutely love about it. And that, I think, comes from, you know, my allegiance,
And we want to say, Joe,
man allegiance.
We want to assure people who are listening, this is a safe space, because as we know, you know, around this table, virtual table, Katie's favorite Michael Mann movie is Collateral. And we cover that on like little digressions that we have on this show, which we love doing, Collateral Confessions. We love it. It's one of Katie's favorite LA movies. My favorite Mann film, of course, is Heat. But I am very open that like when I watch The Insider sometimes, or when I watch Thief sometimes, or when I watch Mohicans, like in the moment I'm watching that, it's my favorite Michael Mann movie. That's what happens when you have your favorite filmmaker. Sometimes they're just, if you're in the right mood, The Insider is the best Mann movie in my opinion.
All right. Now, that brings up a very good point. Now, there are, let's take comedians, for example.
Yeah.
You could take George Carlin. You can take, you know, Richard Pryor. You could take, any Bobcat Goldthwait. You know, you could take all of these comedians, old and new, and you could go, I love their delivery. I love the way they tell jokes, or they tell stories in their own particular way.
Yeah.
And yet, sometimes you can watch like a later set or a later stand-up special or whatever and go, you know, the material, whatever they were talking about, wasn't as good. Or like, you know, take Dave Chappelle, for example. Like, he's obviously gotten much more political and much more progressively controversial at times, but people still bring the baggage of, God, I loved how he told all of these stories. Or Chris Rock, you know, like all these guys who have a very particular voice. And that voice carries into, you might not like the material that they're covering, but you still like their delivery.
Yeah, it's, so every it's Michael the cadence. Mann movie,
it's the
cadence.
Exactly.
It's the rhythms. It's the decisions. As you said, it's like, you know, whatever choice that they make in that into those ends, and it's the choices. It's like, I just like being floored by the choices because they don't seem like that could ever have been made by anyone else.
But anyone else, exactly. And that's where my love for Mann has carried ever since I saw Manhunter. And, you know, I went back to Thief before that. And then from there, it was every movie from then on. I wanted to hear his version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you like the story or not, you still feel like you are captivated to how this person gesticulates with the camera, or gesticulates with the sound, or works with the actors, or the blocking, or the sound design, or just those choices that he makes. And you feel like you are in the hands of someone so competent and so assured on those choices that things that you would otherwise consider a fuck up, a sound, like sound dropping out, like the moment when John Hawks' Alonzo dies and the sound drops out in the movie, that would have gone through QC. Because like anytime we make a movie, I did it like just a couple of weeks ago with our movie. Anytime that you have something that, you know, to someone who's been doing this for years and they watch something and they go like, oh, that's a jump cut, or, you know, this looks like a fucked up frame, or did the sound just drop out all of a sudden? They flagged that. And that felt like a moment that any other filmmaker who did that in a fucking Marvel movie or a Star Wars movie or anybody else, someone would have said, oh, that seems like that's a mess up. Like, I was watching Tokyo Vice, the first episode. There is an egregious jump cut in one of the police station scenes where like it goes from the camera whip pans around and then there is an obvious jump in that. And anyone else, you'd get a studio note, a producer note going like, there's something fucked up there. Michael Mann gets away with it. There's a vitality to what he brings to the table that allows you to go, anything that he's doing, you know that he is, because, you know, we all heard the story about the belt buckle in Ali and how he went through the crowd and found the belt buckle and went, that's wrong. You know, if that motherfucker has that level of detail, he's going to make the choice of saying, when Alonzo gets run over and the camera almost like cuts abruptly with a sound like edit that almost feels like an error, I don't know if it's that it's he's calling attention to the cinematic filmmaking form itself, or that he's just kind of giving Alonso a brief moment of silence.
Yeah.
He gets away with it. And that's the beauty of Michael Mann.
But yes, he is very detail oriented. We talked about how on Ferrari, he's like matching the wallpaper to the authentic wallpaper that was in the actual place. And then also he's like obsessing over like the number of windows in the factory that they're going to shoot the outside of. So like, yes, all of that stuff is intentional. So I think we all sort of feel sort of safe when those little weird things happen, or we like perk up a little and say like, oh, I'm going to pay attention to this. But I want to hear your, like, tell us the narrative, your Miami Vice narrative. You're at the Cinerama Dome on opening night, 2006. What did you think when you walked out of the theater? Were you like, you were so pumped. Were you like, yes? Or were you like, what the fuck was that?
I fucking hated it.
Oh! See, we had to get it. To that.
Katie had to just...
No, and this is why I love you, Katie, because you brought it back around again, you know, which is good, because I can sit here and go like, oh, jump cuts for, the cows come home.
What happened when you walked out of the theater? That's what I want to know.
I was so...
He fought three people in the lobby. No, I'm just kidding.
Blood on the floor.
I honestly remember going, in with all the best expectations. I heard the bad buzz, but I didn't care because you know what? All of Michael Mann's films, very much like James Cameron, all of his films come with the buzz of like, he's a megalomaniac. Oh, he's crazy. He's so detail oriented that the crew hates him. And she's like, then you see the movie and you go, the proof's in the pudding, he gets away with it. And I got to admit, like, now backing up a little bit further, I was an obsessive over Miami Vice. It was one of the shows that my dad, who didn't like movies, my mom loved movies, my dad didn't like movies. The only two shows that we bonded over because, and this is funny because of these two shows are considered very cinematic because of the auteurs behind it, but it was Miami Vice and it was Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. And those two shows were shows that like I could tell and like hated movies otherwise. Like not hated, but like he was just like, you go watch your fucking horror movie shit. But there was something about, because my dad customized cars. He was a fashion designer for cars back in the day in Long Island. And when you have a show that has all those Ferraris and all those Lamborghinis and they're driving very fast and they're shot incredibly well, and you have all that 80s music and you have the Phil Collins on, like, and the rolled up sleeves. Like when we were growing up, that was the epitome of cool. That was the blueprint of cool, was that very show. And we watched all of them. And some of my fucking heroes, like Abel Ferrara, directed episodes. So you can go back and be able to say, like, holy crap, you can see how Mann was infusing the culture with his sensibilities of what cool was, what the Miami culture was in the sensibilities of cool. He had a pulse on cool. Yes. Now, the movie that I watched that fateful night, 17 years ago, and the movie that I watched about 4 days ago, the difference was palpable because it was the unrated cut. So I distinctly remember being in the Cinerama Dome and all of a sudden getting punched in the face by fucking Linkin Park and Jay-Z. like whoa, holy crap, like I thought rap rock was dead, but all right, whatever. But in this, when you have this, I remember going like, wait a second. Like, I remember Michael Mann always be kind of bringing the cool, not kind of pulling cool from 1999 into the fray. It was a very jarring moment. But
it was not looking, like in 2006, like that song was not cool to like.
No, it was. But the thing is, again, I went, okay, all right. All right, Mike. Like, I got you. Like, if you're going to pull if you're going to pull a retro cut on me, there's probably a really good reason, because he's done that in the past and he makes the shit cool. You know, I got to admit, like, you know, looking at the two versions, because I remember the first theatrical cut very well, burned into my fucking retinas.
Yeah, you're never forgetting that.
No, and I did enjoy the unrated director's cut more, because it leaned into things that I think you could tell a studio head was like, we have to have this movie play 5 fucking times. That movie can't be that long. It's a summer movie. You know, you have to trim this shit down. So the whole Smuggler's Run opening was welcome to me. Like, I think it obviously it sets up so much for the storyline later on. I think, man, there's something about that theatrical cut that is so almost non-linear. Plot is secondary.
Yeah.
To both versions to me. You know, it is a movie about mood, about feeling, about attitude, and about rhythm. I couldn't, if you asked me right now what that movie was about, I'd say a trailer blows up in the third act, you know? Like,
it's a movie about loads.
Yeah.
It's about loads.
Oh, it's dropping loads left and right, Katie. There's a whole lot of loads.
It is about transporting loads.
It's about loads. Okay. It's about vectors. It's about more loads.
All right. So here's where I want to pose, because I know that you guys have talked about this movie, you know, ad nauseum.
Yeah.
Watching the movie on the big screen, like in the theater at the Cinerama Dome, and then watching it at home, streaming on a 70-inch screen with really good sound, I was trying to recreate, you know, as good an experience that I can for someone who'd never seen it before with Becca and myself again. And here's what I wanted to pose to you guys. Now, we all know that Michael Mann was one of the first innovators of bringing digital cinema to the forefront, right? He did it for certain shots in Ali. He fully embraced it with Dion Beebe in Collateral, which I think I can go back to that movie and watch that film. And there are shots in that film that I think are some of the most gorgeous things that he's ever done.
Absolutely.
Digital grain or not, right? Yeah. And I, like, as a filmmaker myself, you know, I've done many films in digital, but I was always striving for the look of cinema of days of yore,
yeah.
Not the way that Mann was with, especially with Collateral, and even into this, where it felt like he was trying to push the medium forward with the digital cinematography, especially with all the stuff at night, right? Now, with that, certain lenses are employed a lot more. Certain techniques are augmented, like slow motion is completely different. It has a completely different look in digital as opposed to film. Watching the movie, I wondered if this movie was shot on film, would I like it more? Because there are certain things. Let's take, for example, the scene in the trailer, the big trailer showdown, which I think is the best scene in the movie. I think that is where Mann knew exactly what the fuck he wanted, down to those beautiful wide angle shots of Jamie Foxx, which
when you're in his
wonky close-ups, yeah, that yeah. are like all
yeah
yeah
there's something about the, now if he had Dante Spinotti, you know, throwing in a 10-inch lens on, you know, Jamie Foxx the way that he did with Michael Russell Crowe in The Insider, I think you would have achieved something to that effect. There is an immediacy to digital cinema that makes you feel very much like in the moment. The problem with it, at least again, this is, let me just put a disclaimer up. These, you know, these views and opinions
this
are.
This is a safe place.
I know. It's just like, I think I put on Letterboxd that I gave it 3 stars at the time. And I went, you know what? Check with me in an hour. I might give it 5 stars. Check with me again an hour after that. I might give it no stars. I'm very conflicted. And immediately there were people like, you're bullshit. You got it. It's a masterpiece. Or like, oh, it's too low. Like, this movie does draw a lot of reactions out of people.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot of the cinematic techniques that he's doing in Miami Vice that give it an almost anti-slick feel, whereas if he was shooting it on gorgeous 35mm, you know, with Dante Spinotti, I think that the film, I would have felt more engaged, as opposed to, I hate to say it, but there were so many times that I went, this feels like he, because when you're on set and you're trying to shoot shots and you're giving it to your DP, I do it a lot where I grab my phone and I like shoot the version of like a move, an angle, a lens size, and then I airdrop it to the DP and he goes, this is how we want to do it. Mm-hmm. All there are so many shots in the movie that felt like the behind the scenes version of what Michael Mann was trying to achieve when he was going to shoot it on film, but then went, fuck it, let's just move on, you know. I don't know what it was. I think it's because my eye is still so trained on there is a difference between 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second, which is usually video, and 24 frames per second, which is film, that there is a different reality involved.
Yes.
And I'm so curious what, like, if you guys felt this way or if other like listeners felt that way, where there were moments, like especially in the shootout scenes when they would do slow-mo shots. Oh God. Like, it's the sort of thing that, like, I remember having this old 24P camera back in the day in the old 2000s. There was a camera called the HVX 2000, and it was a digital camera. It was one of the first digital cameras that shot in 24 frames per second. And I was lucky enough, I put myself on a waiting list and I got the first one in LA, and I got hired for every fucking crappy metal video and every hip hop video at the time. But hey, you know what? It paid the fucking bills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I just love the way you put it. Yeah.
Because it was those two extremes, you know, and they all love wide angle lenses. But there was a need for, look, we can't shoot this on film, but if you can make it look like film. So it was a combination of like looking like 24P, which looked like film. And then I would put black bars on the top and the bottom to make it look like 2.3.5.1. And all the video commissioners would be like, wait a second, did you use 16 millimeter anamorphic widescreen? I'm like, sure. Yeah.
Yes.
There is something that look creates for an audience that has so been ingrained in seeing grain, that when you change that aesthetic and you change, and this is my point here, you change the aesthetic on something that has already been established as an IP, right? Let's take, for example, Lord of the Rings, right? You know, the first three Lord of the Rings, lovingly shot in 35 millimeter. And then you go, but wait, there's more. We have The Hobbit and we're going to shoot it in 60 frames per second. And I remember the same thing. I walked into the theater and I went, this looks like a fucking soap opera. I couldn't be immersed in the world because the first three movies came out and they had a very particular look. Miami Vice was shot on film, even for television. It had a very cinematic look. You had Michael Mann was trying to harness the slick kind of feel that he had gotten from Thief and all these other films before that, and all the films from, like, you know, John Borman and Walter Hill and Billy Friedkin and all these kind of cool muscular directors from back in the day, and then try to squish it down at the TV. And now he's now taking that aesthetic and trying to blow it up into, you know, back onto the big screen, but do it with TV kind of technology.
Wait, can I actually push back on that? I don't think he's trying to recreate the show's aesthetic.
Yeah, that's
I think he's trying to do something completely new, and I think that's why people are not connecting to the, or didn't connect to the movie, because they were like, what the hell is this? Because we actually talked to someone, a guy who's from Miami, a filmmaker from Miami, and he said he remembered when and how the show like created like what Miami looks like. Like Miami copied the show and said, oh, that's what people think we are. We're going to become that. And then the movie came out and everyone in Miami was like, what the fuck is this? So yeah. I think he's like consciously breaking the aesthetic. I don't think he's trying to make like a linear thing. And then to the question I think you posed us, which is, would I like this movie better if it was shot on film? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Or just have a different feel for it.
I mean, it would have, obviously, I mean, it wouldn't be the movie that it is. And I think that like, there are some like muddy, digital, messy shots in there, but then you also have
some janky fucking shit in that, like.
Right. But then you also have, like, I think the scene where they're, I've said this a million times, of where they're standing on the roof and you see this huge, crazy sky behind them, like, that's
you'd
so
never get that in film. You'd
beautiful.
Never get that in film.
Like, some of the, like, flying shots, the boat shots, all this stuff, you know, it's stunningly gorgeous. I think the movie is like stunningly gorgeous, and I sort of accept the jankiness, you know, as part of the relationship or the bargain that I'm making with the movie. But I'm going to pose a theory right now. I think that the entire aesthetic, the sound, the digital, whatever, everything about this movie is an embodiment of Sonny Crockett, the character played by Colin Farrell in 2006 or 2005 when they shot it. It's like,
wait, Katie, I thought rap rock was dead.
Yeah, well, Sonny Crockett
brought it back to life.
Does not. It's still alive and well for that man. And he's, I think also, like, I think part of the digital stuff, it like, it ties into the thematics of what they're doing. Like, you have Justin Theroux with these like little dinky cell phones and cameras, and like, it's capturing this like shitty surveillance vibe of what these people are actually doing. But like, I think that Sonny Crockett would, he is the human embodiment of like a 2006 camcorder.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
My mind is fucking blown right now. and because you know what? Here's the thing. You're not fucking wrong. Like, absolutely not.
It's just like, a theory. It's just a theory.
No. But I can automatically like hear, like, you know, if Sonny is not on the case, he's probably listening to Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water.
Yes,
from
he is.
Just casually is. Just driving down the fucking, that bridge in Miami, just kind of, you know.
In a $300,000 Ferrari, by the way. What an incongruity.
If Tubbs was the person that this movie was all about, maybe it's on Beautiful 35.
Yeah, should have been on 35. Absolutely, I agree. Okay,
you know?
But it's also, it's that very specific thing, Joe, because in Oz, Miami Vice was huge too. Huge, like a, what do you call it? Like TV rerun culture here. Like, we got a lot of sort of American culture, like in reruns. But when I saw this, it was like a world I'd never seen before. It's the same way when I look at Heat, and, you know, that's why some people either A, think it's one of the best LA movies ever, or B, they're kind of like, oh, I have never, like, I do associate it as an LA movie, or maybe not, because it doesn't look like the LA you identify from all of the canonical LA things. You're like, oh, okay, cool, like Chinatown. Yeah. And, oh, yeah, Collateral is an LA movie for sure, 100%. Drive, yeah, LA movie. Cool, Speed, yes, got it. But, like Heat makes old drive-ins look like a graveyard.
War zones.
Yeah, like, it looks like a drive-in is like a graveyard in a John Ford Western that someone walks up to a hill and says goodbye to their, you know, bye to a loved one and then go back to town.
It looks like, what is it, All Quiet on the Western Front. Yes. I watched All Quiet on the Western Front recently. I went, that looks like the drive-in in Heat. Holy shit. You know, it's like a fucking war zone. Where are the trenches? Okay.
Yeah.
Now you're going to make me... If this whole point was to make me watch the fucking movie again, you've already done it.
And we also, we have to...
Our plan is working.
We have one slight correction, is that now there are actually three cuts of the movie.
Oh?
There is a Miami Vice from 2006, yeah, which is 17th birthday. Then there's the unrated director's cut. But Joe, there's the Miami Nice cut.
Our own cut.
There's a few.
Tell me more.
There is a fusion of... both cuts, which we had an editor friend of ours put together for us, Vashi Nidamansky. And it is basically the bookends of the movie from the theatrical cut stay the same because Katie and I worship at the church of Nam Encore. And then it has, we like the music a little bit better in the final shootout scene in the theatrical cut. So we kind of put that on. But
and the Trudy scenes. There's more Trudy scenes.
Yeah, but so yeah, that's what I mean. In the middle is all the Trudy scenes. It's all that extended stuff. It's the salutations from my friends in the South. You know, all that. You need that as far as we're concerned because it's just, it helps deepen and enrich the movie. But that's like, that's...
Okay, whoa. Wait. Okay. So, because here, bringing it back to the 1999, I want your opinions, and I think I remember this from earlier episodes, but I want your opinions on the Phil Collins cover. Because, like, which cut, which version of the song is in the Miami Nice? Is it Nonpoint or is it Phil Collins?
So we really tried to get Phil Collins over, and that was our brief. When I spoke to Vashi, I was like, can you please, like, could you make Nonpoint the end music? You take Nonpoint out of the end music in the director's cut and make it Phil Collins. And he couldn't do it. So I'm like, okay, well then just take it out. Like I took out that and I put back the theatrical cut, which doesn't have Nonpoint.
You're already making me go to Premiere right now and drop in that. That is another thing there. Because like when we were talking about before about taking the taking Miami Vice and kind of bringing it into the next century, a whole new generation. And, you know, you're right, Katie, it's not the Miami Vice from the 80s. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder if Mann had just called it Florida Cops.
Not Florida Cops.
I want to see Florida Cops.
I'm making the Florida Cops cut. I'm making the Florida Cops.
Yes. I want to play orderly number two in Florida Cops.
You're
Katie's
hired.
Orderly number one.
But if they had called it anything else, if it was,
I know,
sunny,
I know, I think
if,
you're
if,
right.
If it was
yeah.
Mooney, if it was, if instead of Tubbs, it was Skinny.
Did you
know,
say Mooney?
Like,
Mooney?
Yeah. Instead of Sunny, his name is Mooney.
This
Bill
is
Mooney,
the creativity of Joe Lynch's mind. I just am watching your beautiful mind like come up with this stuff. Like Mooney
am
and
I
Skinny.
Am I like Russell Crowe? Am I like Russell Crowe? Like all these things back here are just parts of my mind.
Okay,
going,
give me the chalk. Mooney.
Florida Cops.
Check.
Florida Cops. I'm obsessed. No,
I'm
I mean.
That movie now.
Right, yeah. No, I think you're totally right that like. People, I mean, Miami Vice is such an iconic cultural property that, you know, I think people were like not expecting it. That's why it did not do well. Also, it had bad press and all this stuff. But I think it's like, you know, it's really found its niche, obviously, now. It's like getting to the point where it's almost too beloved to the point where it's like you can have backlash.
Thing.
Yeah.
It is another movie that I saw opening night a much trashed, reviled film is now on the fucking Criterion Collection is Showgirls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think this is man's Showgirls. And I don't mean that as an insult. I do not mean that as an insult. I mean that in, there is something about when you look at what Verhoeven was trying to do back in 95, and there is a twinkle in his eye. He was on fucking Good Morning America for a whole week promoting Showgirls. There is, people look back at that and go, what the fuck were we thinking?
That's like Chris Nolan on The View. Like the memes of Chris Nolan on The View was into my fucking psychosis. All the memes of that. Oh my God. The best
content. If you would have told me or anyone else the weekend after Showgirls came out and said, hey, fellas, guess what? There's going to be this crazy new technology that's going to take the Criterion Collection, you know, all those laser discs you have that cost $100. They're going to make an entire service where you can watch all their fucking movies. And guess what movie is going to be one of the most popular films at one point? Showgirls. And we're going to go, are you fucking nuts? And here we are.
Yeah.
But the point is that there was a knowing twinkle in Verhoeven's eye, where I think he was in on the joke of how soap opera-y the movie is, and so over the top and so kind of operatic in a way. Like Nomi goes from 1 to 11 like that, right? Now take this with Miami Vice, and there are moments where Sonny's delivery, especially during the negotiation scene, where they're at the table and what is he has like, my mommy and daddy know me.
Yeah. I was literally just thinking that.
That's nice, because we got product that's got to move.
Real tight, you move as fast as FedEx.
Move to where?
To New York, through South Florida.
Move when?
Right now.
It's kind of all of an instant.
That means only one thing, real fast. So price, is it right?
Price is right. But how I know if you any good at this shit?
What's that?
Yeah, your business. How much volume you do? Whose product you move? Who you work with? Other than Nicolas, who the fuck knows you?
Well, my mommy and daddy know me. And we don't talk about who we work with.
We didn't come down here to audition for business. Business auditions for us.
And knows all about us. Before they call Nicholas. That way we don't waste half gas. For our motherfucking time. You want us to be telling you about our shit? You can't find out on your own. Why do I not buy that?
You with DEA, the feed? What's up? They talking to my transport line? You with the man?
You wearing a wire?
Tell you what's gonna happen.
People gonna come in here, you know what they're gonna say? They're gonna look around and they're gonna go, oh, I hear. That's some crazy motherfucking wallpaper. What is that?
Jackson Pollock?
No, viejo. That was Jose Euro. He got splattered all over his own wall.
So, we can close each other's eyes right now real fast.
Then ain't nobody gonna make no.
You want to fuck my partner?
There are lines that are so fucking arch and so overdone that, like, you can't not. Like, I would love to have been in.
Do you know how many times I've sat in a corporate meeting and someone will say a line and then a Miami Vice prompt in my broken brain, like, makes me want to say a Sonny Crockett line? My mommy and daddy know me.
I mean, the dialogue is camp. Like, we have to just admit that the dialogue is camp.
But here's the thing. Like, in 2006, when the movie came out, the show, and again, this is where I think Florida Cops would have been a better choice. We went in where there was no irony. There was no, like, winking to the audience, like, in a 21 Jump Street sort of fashion when Miami Vice came out in the 80s. It was, this is cool. We're taking this serious. We are not fucking around here. We're not making a joke out of it. This is, if you want to be cool, roll up your sleeves, grab a mojito, and go bust some fucking drug dealers. Like, that's how you did it. And then you're now taking that and you're doing it as like almost like a high school play version of it, like in this new version. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but this is where I'm curious if you guys felt the same way, because watching it back in 2006 and watching it in 2023 were two vastly different perspective screenings for me. Because now I can watch it and I sit there and go, did he know that he was making high camp the whole time, the way Verhoeven felt like he was making camp the whole time with Showgirls? Was there something where he's going, this is so fucking ridiculous. I'm getting paid so much money to throw at the screen with these amazing actors and they're acting like nincompoops. Like, but done in a way where they are not winking to the camera. They are doing it seriously, but it's serious camp. And it's not like, it's that thing like in Back to the Future where Marty McFly goes like, look, you might not like it now, but your kids are going to love it. Like this movie almost feels like it wouldn't have been appreciated at the time, especially because, you know, we're 4 years removed from the moment where everyone said, are we allowed to laugh again? Are we allowed to be like, mm-hmm. after 9/11, everybody, we got into torture porn. We got into very serious films that it felt like we couldn't be like funny, or we couldn't make fun of ourselves. We couldn't take a piss, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a time where we couldn't get into those kind of campy histrionics. I think now I will say this. Whereas I walked out of Cinerama Dome fucking, you know, so disappointed and hating and everything, I finished watching this and I went, I enjoyed it a lot more. You know, I still feel like there are moments that like just don't work for me. I think that the digital cinematography kept taking me out of the moment, aside from that trailer park scene, like inside there, which I thought was, he would not have been able to achieve that level of intimacy, that intense intimacy, without the digital bravado of the digital cameras being able to give what he got.
I want to forgive you though on that. You know, appreciating cinema is obviously a subjective experience, and when you can find a little campfire or a very horny campfire, as we sort of stoke here on Miami Nice, like you can find people who are all on the same page. But your eye is trained to what you can achieve because that's your job, right? So like when you look at the trailer park, that's where the theme and the form probably harmonize the most, because you're like, yes, I could not do it anywhere. When I go to those rooftops and people are talking, I can't make the sky look like it's a impressionist painting with these like weird hues of like that kind of, I don't even know.
Olive kind
of
sky.
It's like olive sky, but it's then that weird orange from just like the permeating sort of like streetlights that, you know, in this massive, massive array of streetlights. I can't do that any other way. And then you're looking at then the budget of like, with all my other stuff, with all the other tools in my hand, the choice is not going, I'm going to blend some form here. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to shoot it in 35 because on 35, then I'm really going to see the curves of the Ferraris and I'm really going to see the sweat and I'm really going to see the skin texture and I'm really going to like the frame rate. So, you know, you can forgive yourself for that. But Katie, your first experience of Miami Vice was like, you were like, this is a curio. This is a weird movie, other than Colin Farrell, because Katie is the president of the Dirtbag Hall of Fame. She was like, I may have a new inductee here. Other than that.
I said, don't let this awaken something in me. But it was already there. It was already awake.
It was awake.
Yeah, so I saw this for the first time in grad school, in like 2013, 2012, and
What made you not see it before? Just no interest at all in mojitos, or?
I'm gonna be completely honest. I think I was breaking up with my boyfriend at the time.
And there, look, there's no worse movie to watch than Miami Vice. You know, you'd be like, I bet he would have liked this fucking movie.
I think that was the summer of 2006 was just intense.
Denim. There was big belts.
I was wearing vests. Huge belts. They were literally hanging me onto the ground. I couldn't get up off the floor. Studded belts were just trapping me to the ground. I don't know.
Playing in the background.
Yeah, you know, totally. Maybe. I was like going to Electro Clash shows in Brooklyn or something.
If I had a fucking time machine, people like I'd go back and kill Hitler. Nah.
All of us just went to Williamsburg for like 10 seconds.
Right.
Oh my God. Holy fuck.
I don't know. I think I just was like not paying attention to it. I'm just being totally honest.
What drew you to see it then? Like when you did?
I literally had to, I was played in my class.
Please mention your professor again.
My professor played it in my class that I was taking in grad school at USC, Reagan's America, parentheses, Crack Nation. Dr. Boyd, shout out. We need to get him on
the
pod.
It's Todd Boyd, right? He's yeah, Todd in. Boyd. I could just say, we've said his name a bunch of times now.
Yeah.
He's in, oh my God, what was it? He's in The Last Dance.
Yeah, he's like in every single documentary as a talking head.
Yeah, he's a talking head in The Last Dance at some point.
Yeah,
and I remember.
We just are. This entire class was. We read huge books about Reagan and then watched movies about drug dealers. There's a whole class. Great class.
Sign me up. That sounds great.
Very illuminating.
Take it over the summer.
But I remember watching it and being like kind of laughing at it. And I think you are bringing in an idea that I feel is a little bit taboo to talk about in the Miami Vice, the current Miami Vice fandom, which is that this movie is camp, but it's also serious camp. Like, I think the way a lot of younger people watch it now, they're so like reverent about watching it. And like, if I'm at a repertory screening and anybody laughs at Miami Vice, like, I hate these people. I'm like, bitch, it's funny. Like, my mommy and my daddy love me. Like, I'm a disco guy. Like, this shit is funny. So, and I don't know. I have no idea if Michael Mann was like intentionally doing his little Verhoeven wink of like, it's kind of funny. But I think he was also trying to capture, I don't know, like these swaggering Florida cops. And maybe he was like, yeah, they're kind of corny. they're listening to Limp Bizkit. This is in the book of Sonny's, you know, character backstory. I bet is like all the Limp Bizkit albums. But yeah, I do think like, but I think what's so weird about this movie is that it's a strange experience of being like, this is action, but it's camp. But then at the end, you're like, oh my God, I'm genuinely heartbroken for these two people who are separating, and I'm moved that Trudy is surviving, and it just takes you through such a strange journey of emotions.
What happens?
I have to admit, I
want to describe something for you, Joe, really quickly. Is at the beginning, we've done it. We've screened Miami Nice virtually a couple of times, and at the beginning, our crew, who is on our Discord and our patrons, who are just the best people. They're just a treasure trove of people. The beginning is us laughing. Katie initiated a Miami Nice drinking game, which
it's not allowed anymore.
It's not allowed anymore. It's canceled because she was
it's
like,
drink every time they say loads. I had to call it about 20 minutes in. I said,
Katie's
no,
like,
stop
you're done.
Katie's like, stop, guys. It has to stop. Yeah. But it starts out with us all having such a great time, you know, other than John Hawks. There's a lot of reverence in that saying, but we're all laughing, we're all quoting, and then at the end, we're all like saying, I love you guys, this movie's so wonderful. Like, it literally is such an arc, and it has happened so many times that I'm like, this is it. There is an unreplicable experience watching Miami Vice. It's like funny, camp, weird. And then when that fucking end music goes up and Gong Li's face, like just that, the precursor shot, and Gong Li's face is on a big screen in front of you and the music's playing and she looks out and she's rolling like a single tear. I'm like, you know, like it's that Bong Joon-ho meme of like, to me, this is cinema. Like, that's it. Yeah. Like, you're at the end of it, you're like crying. You're like, I need a rest. And you know, like I've walked out of like a Miami Nice screening and like nearly had tears in my eyes, and my wife's like, you're all right. I'm like, I thought you were podcasting. I'm like, yeah, it's just a good movie and I love everyone. Yeah.
it does take you on a roller coaster of emotions. It's just that, like, again, you're getting on the roller coaster with a preconceived idea of what you're going to expect, because, I mean, for me, it was because of the TV show. Maybe for another generation who had never grown up with that, they were going, it's the director of Heat, it's the director of, you know, Collateral.
Or Colin Farrell fans or whoever, yeah. Like, yeah.
I think it's the closest thing that man has ever done to Kabuki theater. That's the reason why, like, when you brought up camp, not that I retract that, but there are two sides to that camp. There is the, you know, pompous, almost John Waters type of camp. And then there is the...
Which only he can do to that level. Camp. He can only do that. He's like...
Wait, but what was the other kind of camp you were going to say? There's John Waters camp, okay, and then there's...
There's John Waters, and then there is like Verhoeven, where...
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, because if you look at Verhoeven's, you know, American efforts, maybe even like Flesh and Blood as well, but if you look at his American efforts, RoboCop, maybe not Total Recall, Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
Those are films that if you turn the sound off and you could watch it straight-laced, it is presented to you cinematically without any tongue-in-cheek. You listen to the dialogue, however, and you can, you know, see the sound matching the film's visuals, and then you go, what the fuck did they just say? it changes things to, it feels like you are taking drama and trying to go for the cheap seats. And that's what Kabuki theater is in many cases. Mm-hmm. You are heightening all the drama using form and movement. And for example, like with Kabuki, you are using costumes and makeup because, you know, those are the cinematic, or those are the tricks that the theatrical proscenium arch had. For filmmakers, completely different. Man, if he was trying to make a joke out of this movie, this is where, like, I feel like I want to make sure that I'm being clear here. Mm. I don't think he would have shot it in digital. I think he would have shot it to make it look exactly like if he was making a joke. The part of the best spoofs that we know of, like the Zucker Brothers, you know, or even Lord and Miller, those guys knew that they have to take what you expect aesthetically and then subvert it.
Yeah.
The man wasn't trying to do that with this.
No, I think he's
pushing the technique forward completely.
I think he's deadly serious, because if you think about all the like research and stuff that goes into it, and he really wants to talk about the Ciudad del Este and the Aryan Brotherhood and the drug traffic, like, it's like there's so much in, you know, he's trying to make it contemporary-ish. Michael Mann makes, like, he doesn't make only action movies. Like, he makes historical things.
Yeah, dramas.
Dramas. But fundamentally, I think all of his movies are male melodramas. And this is a male melodrama.
Yeah, big time.
And sometimes melodramas tip into camp.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. And this is something that I have learned in my own journey as a visual storyteller. You don't get this when you start out making movies. You think you know it, but like it takes birthing a child, so to speak, a cinematic baby, you know, a film kid. When you do that, you know, you do everything you can from prep to execution to promotion to set that kid off into the world and hope and pray that it lives a long life and, you know, gets embraced by its friends or deals with its peers in certain ways and just try to goes and lives its life. It's time that evolves both a person and a piece of art. And again, like watching this movie again, like a lot of Michael Mann's movies, because there's a certain ones like The Keep, like Manhunter, maybe not Heat and Last Mohicans, which are two of my favorites. More Black Hat, I feel, also benefits from this a little bit. But time changes and evolves a movie in the audience's perception. And I honestly think, like, yeah, you're right. Michael Mann doesn't seem like the type of guy who's like Joe Bob Briggs, where he can just kind of like roll off a really bad joke and everyone goes like, "Oh, you old coot," you know. Like, I don't see him being the jokiest type of dude. Maybe he is. Who knows? You know. Mm-hmm. Maybe
he likes to bust balls. I think.
Like 100%. I think he's very dry. if you will.
The thing you just nailed something, which I think is one of like we can sort of end on, is Michael Mann. For the longest time, this is the itch, and you articulated of like all of Michael Mann's movies from the second he makes them feel like they are temporarily displaced. So you see them and you're like, you see Thief and it's made in 80. That's literally the closest movie that is made to a mood, a time, a socio-political outlook, a formal style. It is as close to the thing that it's making because it feels like a new Hollywood movie, and really new Hollywood goes all the way up to Thief, Raging Bull, etc. But then the rest of his movies are all these massive existential dramas, whether they're crime drama, whether it's a, you know, or like this high concept sci-fi and stuff like that with The Keep. They're all kind of made, and none of them ever really feel like they're of the time that they're made. They all feel like they, you know, they sometimes anchor themselves with music, and maybe that he launches a performer that has never been seen before, etc. But they all feel like, and even with Miami Vice, the TV show, that show is like a light year, like just like one single turn of the sun ahead of, it's the precursor. Because as Katie was talking about, which I think was so great in that episode we did with Jason Fitzroy, was like, Miami Vice showed people what Miami was, and then Miami became it. It was like a self-actualization. But like every one of his movies do this. They kind of all feel like weird, out-of-time things because he's anchored in a very, like, very specific, very rich worldview of like that, like new Hollywood filmmaker. And he just kept making them. And all the philosophical, social, political ideals and you know, all that stuff just keeps going forward, but they all feel like they're anchored. So they feel super weird when they come out. Sometimes they hit and it just resonates, and other times they don't. And then like a decade later, and I think this is just for everything, it's like, you know, so many of the contemporary movies are just, the formally, they don't have the aspiration, they don't look great, and we're so like deadened with, you know, different streaming dramas and stuff, that when you see a Michael Mann movie, you're like, this does not resemble anything I've seen in the last year. And so that's why
It was the most refreshing, one of the most refreshing things that I watched. If you follow me on Letterboxd, I watch a lot of shit. And not just shit, but like I just watch a lot of films. And like we were going through, I think in the last, like right before Miami Vice, we watched about 11 movies in 36 hours. You know, like it was a, like we went on a marathon and watched every movie from, you know, there was a lot. I will say that watching Miami Vice, to your point, Blake, is whether you love it or you hate it, you cannot deny that this is the output of a filmmaker who has a very particular pulse that he is tapping into. No matter what, whether you're into listening to that kind of pulse, or you're like, no, that's not my thing. But it is interesting to see like how, you know, here's someone who started out really, I mean, Thief was, you know, like a kind of underground hit, you know, in a way, or was like more of a cult classic, but no one really knew who Michael Mann was, and he didn't really have the grasp that he did until Miami Vice. Yeah. And then to almost go all the way through his filmography up to the new one, it was just an interesting evolution in seeing how here's a filmmaker that epitomized cool, and I felt like he pushed cool. I even called it like he went, it's funny that he uses the word slick, you know, like obviously we know that he loves that word slick, and someone even says slick in the movie again. And that was something that you can go through every one of his movies, even something like Last of the Mohicans. There are moments that you could technically, someone would go like, oh, that's slick. You know, there is, he is the epitome of slick. He is the godfather of slick. This movie felt so anti-slick by using that the digital form to make it so grainy and so it felt rough around the edges. That gunfight at the end, there's a shot where, I'm sure you guys know the shot I'm talking about, but it's the handheld shot that's like from the bad guy's perspective, and it goes from low angle and runs from one dude to the other. It almost feels like that wasn't supposed to happen. And yet And it's so anti-slick. It's not the sort of thing that otherwise a filmmaker would put, you know, dolly track going from point A to point B, and even put the person on handheld camera, but there would be a fluidity to it.
Yes.
This has none of that. And I think that that's something that he leaned into so much that as an audience member, you just have to embrace it or not. And you know what? I will say that I didn't embrace it at all in 2006. I'm giving it a bro hug in 2023 now.
Well, you know,
this movie
that's all we can ask for
right now in this episode, because you're an LA staple. We can announce Katie, but Joe, you're going to go from a bro hug to a salsa dance, because one Katie Walsh in person, and perhaps even me from Australia virtually, are introducing the opening night at the American Cinematheque Podcast Festival, and the opening film is Miami Vice.
Oh my God. On the big screen, what, at the Arrow?
No, at the Los Feliz 3.
At the Los Feliz 3.
Good, good, good. Because you know what? Like, the Los Feliz 3 has great seats. If you go to the Arrow, any movie over 2 hours, your ass is going to be fucking dead. So Miami Vice at the Los Feliz 3 is the perfect movie, because those seats are very accommodating to whatever version of Miami Vice that you may want to watch. Which is going to be on the long side. That's amazing. Congrats.
Yeah. So we Thursday, August 24th. At the Los Feliz 3 at 7 p.m., it's the American Cinematheque Friend of the Fest Podcast Festival. We are going to be introducing Miami Vice, and I'm sure we'll have lots of...
Which cut?
I actually don't know yet, but they haven't told me.
Let's send them the
nice
cut.
Is there time for me to what I want to do, here's my final proposal.
Okay.
Is, you know, there, you're saying that there's three versions of Miami Vice. You know what? Fuck it. Why not? You know, like, let's go for four. Let's go. I'm going to take Miami Vice, because, like, my biggest criticism of the movie, you know, or my biggest observation from a very subjective standpoint, is that I'm not the biggest fan of the digital cinematography. I even posed to both of you, and even to the viewer or the listener, that, like, what if this movie looked like it was shot on 35? I bet that there is some AI thing. I know we're not allowed to talk about AI or whatever, but I bet you that there's some GPT software out there that I know has been used in, like, the last couple of years to remaster a lot of films from, you know, 16 millimeter 35 to
color grading. Yeah.
I almost want to sabotage. I want to sneak into Deluxe. I want to do a fucking heist, like in Heat. I want to sneak into Deluxe or Technicolor. Find that, like, fucking supercomputer, like, AI system, probably from Rollerball, stick Miami Vice into it, and then go beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 and have a 35 millimeter kind of look added to that movie, just this to see what it would look like. And I'm calling it the Florida Cops Cut.
Okay. Okay. I think, you know, I support you. I think it's sacrilege, but I support you.
We
just want you to be happy, Joe. We want you to be happy.
I would, you know what? I'd probably watch it and go, this was a big mistake. And then, you know, like, fucking Skynet will become aware because of that movie and go, wait, what the fuck is this movie? And blow this all up.
You should just do it to the trailer or something and see if it, like, just do it as a test case.
I'm very tempted. I just want to see what that would look like. You know, like, yes, but then again, like, that's the beauty of art, is that no matter what, we hopefully, you know, notwithstanding it doesn't get cut like fucking French Connection did on Disney or whatever, where they're cutting shit out. But thankfully, you know, there is that version. There's that version and two other versions of Miami Vice that you can enjoy, you know, that are definitive extensions of who Michael Mann is as a storyteller. And whether you love it or hate it, you can't, again, like I said before, that is a filmmaker that knows exactly what he wants, whether you like it or not. Like, if anything, like, sometimes you can watch, like, when I watched Miami Vice, there were times where I'm going, it felt like he was even saying, like, oh, so you want Miami Vice, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, I think that's exactly what he's
that's
doing.
That's it.
To that, I go, you're the man. And well, I give him the fucking the bro fist pump that they do that was in every fucking trailer that you knew you would cut to the fucking music.
I'll never doubt you, Joe. I'll never doubt you.
Well, if we have learned anything over the past 3 years, it's that this movie makes you want to talk about it a lot and debate it with your friends and talk about your passions and your qualms and the things that make you laugh. And so please do come to our screening on Thursday, August 24th.
Does the Los Feliz 3 serve alcohol?
No, but afterwards, I will all go to the Dresden and have drinks.
Right around the corner. Yeah.
And yeah, for sure, we'll have drinks afterwards.
It would not be right for us to do the drinking game at a rep screening because people you might have to have paramedics on site.
Yeah. You can have a sip of your Diet Coke every time they say loads. but nothing else, at least that I want to know about. But anyway, yeah, so please do come if you're in LA or want to get to LA or whatever on 24th of August. Also, Travis Woods is presenting Inherent Vice and
sure
Inherent
is.
Vice on the 26th, which is Saturday. So lots of fun podcasts. OHM Pods is being represented twice. We're taking this thing over. So it's going to be fun.
God, the crowds in those screenings, I would give anything to be with them. They're just my horny people. Bless you.
Yes.
Now, speaking of horny people, Joe Lynch, Suitable Flesh, you're about to roadshow out. It's going to go to Tribeca. You guys have got your screening there, this Lovecraftian adaptation.
We actually had our Tribeca premiere last month. I'm still in shock. I'm still pinching myself, mainly because this is a different movie for me. It's funny that you mentioned the word horny. Every single review on Rotten Tomatoes has all reveled in the word horny.
And amazing.
I'll be honest. I listen to a lot of Carina Longworth. The fact that she just did the erotic 80s and 90s was almost serendipitous to when this movie came out because, you know, like, we're missing sex in movies these days. And, you know, and there's nothing better than to take something like, I don't know, like an old H.P. Lovecraft story and infuse it with a lot of horniness. You know?
Yeah.
There is an audience for that. So,
there is.
And they're called the One Heat Minute Productions listeners. Yeah.
Well, you know what? You clearly are all very, very horny people. So I think you guys will dig it. If this is dropping next Thursday, so if you're in the Canada area, it's playing at the Fantasia Film Fest on the 5th. I will be there for that. It's going to be in a couple other festivals that have not been announced, but they're pretty big. I'm still so close to the movie. It's hard for me to watch movies like from Michael Mann when I'm making films because you sit there and go, Jesus Christ, he had probably 30 takes to just get that one insert. Whereas, you know, in most cases when it's the budget of my level, it's like, you get one and you're shooting it off your fucking iPhone. and there are shots in Suitable Flesh that were done exactly like that. So it's hard for me to watch movies like that. It's hard for me to watch my own movie right now because I'm so close to it. But the reactions so far have been great. If you love H.P. Lovecraft, if you love movies like Reanimator, for example, this is a love letter to Stuart Gordon and Dennis Paoli and Brian Usna and all the guys that made Reanimator and From Beyond, so much so that if you're a very astute viewer, this is almost, I don't want to give too much away, but this is almost a spiritual sequel to Reanimator, if you will, part of the Miskatonic verse that we keep lovingly calling the movie.
It stars Barbara Crampton.
We love
Barbara. Her. Barbara Crampton, Heather Graham, Judah Lewis from the Babysitter. You have never seen Judah Lewis like this. Jonathan Scheck, Bruce Davidson. It's a great cast.
Love Bruce Davidson, by the way.
He's amazing. I got blessed with this movie. It was not an easy movie to make, but I'm so thrilled it's coming out. So it'll be on the Fleshtival tour, as I've been calling it, for the next couple months. Thankfully, due to Tribeca, the distributor is now talking theatrical, which is
amazing,
exciting.
Right?
And
just
midnight
screenings only. Just get like, yes, let's do it.
It's funny you should mention midnight screenings, Mr. Howard, because I've been thrilled because Katie, I don't know if you're you've ever gone to the New Art in Los mm-hmm. Angeles. I used to go all the time to all the midnight shows. I used to actually present anytime Mandy would show at the New Art. I used to live down the street and go, I'm introducing Mandy tonight. But I love that theater. It's been a staple of the midnight scene, midnight movie scene, since Eraserhead played there and Pink Flamingo as well. It just so happens that one of my earlier efforts, Mayhem, which had a very brief theatrical run back in 2017, is
great
playing
movie.
A midnight show this September 1st at the New Art. I cannot wait to see it on the big screen again. Because when it first came out, no one saw it. But thanks to Shudder and physical media over the last couple of years, it's really amassed a really good following. Plus, the two actors that are in it have kind of blown up a little bit. Steven Yeun and Samara Weaving have kind of done a couple of things since Mayhem. So we're going to be doing a screening of that at the New Art on September 1st at midnight-ish, I guess. I think they're doing it a little earlier. But please come out. If you've never seen it on the big screen or you want to see it again, come out and hang out with us.
I'm literally typing it into my calendar right now.
Yeah, do that.
Katie Walsh, if you come, I'm buying you a drink, and I will make sure that you get in, and I will get you a fucking special seat because I'm a big fan, and I'd love for you to see the movie there.
Oh, yes, Mayhem fucking rules. Nothing better than that. Oh my god, Steven is so good in that movie. Samara is so fantastic. So good, man. It's been way too long since talking to you. You're the best. Thank you so much for doing the show. Thank you for having a conflicted experience. We'll try and get your hands on the Miami Nice cut and just take you.
I really want to see it.
We'll take you to the limit one more time.
I need some inspiration for Florida Cops that I'm currently in the
belt. Yes, definitely. You're going to be rewatching a lot, but I loved this conversation because I love having, wrestling with these big ideas. And so it was a great time talking to you. And thank you for bringing, all of these provocative questions to our little campfire.
I'm just a wide angle lens of questions.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.